After 30 minutes, but you know, it's really nice to have a night class. It was too full. And it shouldn't be. Sorry, this is lecture 4 of Covenant, the seriousness of Covenant. Just keep your eye on that. I think I'd like to review, which is why I put this up here again, because I want us to remember that there's this line going through, that we're progressing here, that we're building one on top of the other. Because I'm going to pull away a little bit from where the lesson went. I'm going to talk about the seriousness of covenant, but we need to talk about the Mosaic or the Sinai covenant, and then bring it into the seriousness. Because really that gives us the background of what type of seriousness we're talking about. And I think it gives us a little more idea of where we're going. So I love the fact that we look at the seriousness of covenant and we look at all these different aspects of covenant. But it's very difficult for me to throw out the progression. So that's where I'm always going to go. I'm always going to try to bring us to the progression. So we're going to look at that. But I want us to remember that there's a progression, not just of the story and not just that each covenant builds on the other, but also that God's revelation of himself builds on the other. And so that those give us fuller pictures. So we can't just pick out one thing, but it helps us to see that. And the progression of God's character revealed to us is also the progression of the status that we're given revealed to us. It progresses one on top of the other. So we can never talk about who we are without talking about who God is. And we can't talk about who God is without talking about the covenant and how he's revealed who he is. So that's why I want us to keep this in mind as we go through. So remembering that we began with Adam and Noah, remember that's one phase of the covenant. We talked about God revealing that he's gracious and attentive, and that those things are needed, right, in any relationship. And they're necessary to have relationship and to have this mutual dependence or interdependence. I also want to pull back on when we talk about mutual dependence. I always use mutual dependence. Interdependence is probably a better vocabulary. But I want to be careful on that because it's not codependence, right? So it's codependency is a transaction. You understand that? Codependency is I do this for you, so you do this for me. But mutual dependence is an interdependence. It's an integrity. And it's interesting, the more and more I see about people using the word integrity, it really is what God is talking about here. So we see that with the Adam and Noah phase of covenant. So that he wants us to have a relationship, but it's a relationship of interdependency, of mutual dependency. And then last week we talked about the Abrahamic covenant and that he revealed himself as with or as Abraham's shield or as our defense. And that was necessary for them to understand that God is gracious and he's attentive, but he could still be that and be here, right? Be apart. And this with part is so important for us to understand. Because I think even us who love the Lord and we have him in our lives, many times we still think of him as over here, right? Rather than here, rather than with. And that's an essential piece of understanding who God is, that he is with us, that he's on our side. That remember, there's two sides, and the whole thing about the Noah thing is he says, I'm putting up my weapons. There's not going to be a side for me to go on. I am with you. And his being with us also translate into my presence, my withness, translates into who you are. You become my treasured people. Now, obviously, when he tells Abraham that, Abraham can't be a treasured people, but he is going to be the father of a treasured people. So this week, we get to see that treasured people and what that looks like. So today we'll go into Moses and his revelation of holiness. The other thing I want you to remember is that these three aspects of God's character are the mirrors of these. So holy and with are the mirrors of each other. King and attentive are the mirrors of each other. Source of life and graciousness are the mirrors of each other. These kind of show what those look like. Does that make sense? So as we look at the review of where we've been going, let's see how much you can do without looking at your papers. At some point, I probably will give you just a little like paper that says, what is the telos of covenant? And you will say,
right relationship.
What is the purpose of covenant?
Revelation.
Revelation of what?
Of God.
Three things. God's
person,
God's person.
Position.
And power.
Okay, good. So God's person, who is he?
Holy.
Holy. And because he's holy, he's going to be with us. He'll to shield and defend us, to defend our image-bearing status, to defend our treasured possession status, to defend our regency status, all of those things. Because he's holy, he will defend us, and he'll be with us in those things. So that's how we need to remember what's going on in each of those so that we understand what he's doing. And now we understand that he defends us. His defense is of our status, right? And I think that that gives us a nuance so that we don't expect God to defend us to have our picture accomplished, which is where we often think about, right? Oh, if God's my defense, that means my picture is that, you know, I will have this family of missionaries and I will have, you know, right? God's not defending that. God says, no, I defend your status. You are my image bearer, and exactly how I've made you, you're going to image bear for me in that way, in that unique way. And you're my treasured possession, and you're going to have a part in my plan, and I'm honoring you with that, and you're going to do it in the way I've made you. So it's going to look different. I've been, I don't know how many of you know the Enneagram. Do you know of that? So when you read about the Enneagram and you read about the places, the things that kind of define certain people, you recognize that these are all together, all of the numbers on the Enneagram or all the different personalities, whatever you want to say, really bring us into a whole of image bearing. And it's beautiful if you recognize, oh, that's what God's defending of me. Not my picture, not my tendency towards self-absorption, but this idea of reflection of God. So that's the holiness of God, because God wants us to be whole, right? To always be giving out. So God's person is holy. God's position is
king.
And because he's king, it means he'll be attentive to my regency status. He'll be attentive to what I need as a regent. And again, we'll talk about that when we talk about the Davidic covenant. But for him to be attentive to my needs, the needs are of me being a regent, of me stewarding his creation and his people well, of tending people well. So again, that's a little different than his being attention to things that we want him to pay attention to. And then God's power is?
Source of life.
Right, he's the source of life, right? He's the one who gives life. And because of that, he will be gracious. He will continually pour out his life so that we can pour out his life to others. So those aspects of God's revelation, him revealing those, reveal to us also what he's doing in our lives and our purpose underneath all of that. So it's, I think, covenant being a revelatory mechanism is really important for us to understand so that we don't just think about it as some really cool things. That's how I used to think of covenant. I used to think, wow, God has just done so many cool things. He defends us and he puts his robe on us. Those are all cool. But there's this underlying purpose of upholding who he is and then upholding who we are so we can uphold who he is. So it's this beautiful perichoretic flow that comes from that. So the basis of covenant is
grace.
And what is grace an expression of?
Hesed and
Emmet. Hesed and Emmet, right. Hesed love and Emmet faithfulness. And remember, Emmet faithfulness is always this transparency to show what is true. And then God's power, the movement of covenant is?
Progressive.
That means that each phase of covenant builds on the past and then informs the next phase of covenant, which is kind of what we've been going through here. The practices of covenant. There's three practices, three categories of practices. Signs, sacrifices, solemn oaths. So signs are there for two reasons. One, to bring to mind the goodness of the relationship. So a ring is a sign of marriage, and we, one of the reasons we wear a ring for our marriage vows is to remember that this is a good thing. That's why it's made of valuable metals. You don't usually wear a wedding band that is, you know, one that you can size back and forth and, you know, get at Kohl's for $20. Usually not, unless you can't afford anything more. But that's usually, it's valuable, right? Sometimes ridiculously valuable. To remember the goodness of the relationship. But the second reason is to keep us accountable. Oh, I am committed to this relationship. And not only do I need to remember this, but I need it to be known in the public realm as well. In one of the groups, they're talking about what you did for Lent, what you've decided to give up for Lent. And then as soon as they said it, it was like, now I voiced it. Now I'm accountable, right? Well, that's what a wedding ring does, right? I'm showing everybody, like, I'm accountable. I can't pretend I'm not married. I can't now begin to act with other people in inappropriate ways, right? Because people look at, and most women kind of look right away, right? Are they married or not? Mm-hmm. Like, they look right at their hands. So signs are for that. So we talked a couple signs. Gifts are a sign. Usually the gifts are exchanged. And so we talked about three different gifts. The first one was a robe. And what does that signify? Yeah, status. It's status and identity. So because once you put it on, it's status given to you once you put it on. But if my identity is still on, right, that underneath coat, the two things are going to have friction, right? I can't wear an identity that doesn't match my status. I can, and most of us do, but there's always going to be friction about it, right? So the idea is when God gives us the status of his own self, his own life, that we absorb that, but first we take off. So the gift, the exchange of gifts, the idea is always taking off what was mine and giving it up. Weapons?
I was just going to say, our preacher last Sunday said something about covenant and marriage, which I thought was really, really cool. Because, you know, today, covenant and marriage doesn't mean anything. You know, you get married and you get divorced, you whatever. But anyhow, he said, you do it in front of the altar. And he says, and the altar is where things die.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And something has to die for that covenant to be formed. And what is dying is the single man and the single woman are dying, and now they are a husband and wife. And so I thought that was just so cool, because that's exactly what we're talking about here. The old has to die.
That's right.
And then the new is taken.
Right.
And that's the beginning of the new.
Yeah, exactly. Weapons, what do they signify? Defense, right? Mm-hmm. So that we no longer defend ourselves, but that God defends our status, right? Mm-hmm. And we defend God by living for him, not by verbally saying, that's not right. That's not defense. But that we give witness to goodness of who he is and a witness to the goodness of his relationship. We're actually talking even more about that today.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
I think it is that so many, I think, churches and feel like we need to defend God so strongly. I mean, where did that all start?
Cultural.
Just from the...
Yeah, I mean, it's what we think about. When we hear defending God, that's what we think about, right? Oh, I just have to speak up to him.
Right, or speak up for him.
Speak up for him.
Like a lawyer.
Yeah, like a lawyer. Right, right. We'll talk more about that today, and you'll get to see some of the nuances of what that looks like. Remember, when we talk about telling the truth, those three things, the propositional, the narrative, and the incarnational, the strongest way to tell the truth is narrative. Live it of your life, right? Propositional, I can say lots of things. I can say That is the best way to do it. But it really means very little, right? When I defend God by saying it, well, yes or no. But when I defend God by living it, that is the strength of it, right? That's the huge strength of it. To give some fleshly examples are wonderful, but when I live it across the board, and remember, all of these things, and I think this is probably for me the hardest thing, is all of these things are communal. And we always think about them as individual, right? I have to be this. But it's communal. And that's why I said what I said before you went to group. The fact that the world seems to think that we are committed to a form of religion rather than committed to a relationship says that across the board, as the body of Christ, we're not showing that. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem, mainly because we look at all these things and we take it as an individual. Well, I'm doing it right. They're not, but I'm doing it right. And that's a big deal as far as covenant goes. Covenant is always for the community. As a body, we show who God is. So that way, too, is it's easy for us to, as a body, to say something. But as a body, are we showing it? Do we live a narrative that says, oh, look at those people? If you read
the invitation,
that's the invitation. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I always find it funny that one of the things we talk about when we talk about witnessing, I find it hilarious that people say the best way to witness is bring people to church. Mm-hmm. Really? Is it? The best way to witness is to love your neighbor as yourself and show them what God is like, right? To have this narrative. I bring people to church if I do that because it's easier to say something, come to church with me, mm-hmm. and somebody will talk to you.
Because you're not comfortable, yeah.
Right, yeah. Right? But people want to see, know that they're valued, right? So that narrative is, I mean, we could talk a long time on this, right? Mm-hmm. But knowing covenant best and knowing that covenant is talking about community, I think encourages us to live the truth and then be able to say, oh, in fact, isn't the New Testament say this all the time? Be ready in season, out of season, when somebody says, where is your hope? Why would they ask that question? Why would they ever ask that question to you? Because they see it in your life.
And then you never really have to ask them to church. They're like, they want to come.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great question to ask somebody if you wanna evangelize. Ask them, where's your hope?
Right, exactly. Exactly. So,
you know, Jill, I was listening to the news yesterday, and it, going back to just feeling worth and belonging, it was a guy they were interviewing that said, I could have been a school shooter. I was at a point where he goes, I just couldn't get all the means, and he goes, what turned my life around? He goes, there was one day I wanted to commit suicide. Mm-hmm. He goes, but someone reached out to me and invited me to go eat with them.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and I'm alive because I felt loved.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
It was so powerful.
You know, that's interesting you say it because I've been reading a lot on what are people doing one more shooting.
Right.
Read the best article. I thought, this guy knows what he's talking about. He said, the answer isn't in laws. Mm-hmm. The answer isn't in making sure we have all the security at school. The answer is in showing love to one another. And this was not a Christian guy. To showing each other that they're valuable, particularly those people who are on the outside.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's where it begins. And I thought, yes, mm-hmm. finally we get it. That's where it's going to be. These are horrible things that happen, but we don't react by going on the outside. We respond by saying, there is a person there who did not feel loved. There's a person there who did not feel that they belonged or were valuable. And that's where we need to start. And Christians should be in the forefront of that. Easy to get on a soapbox on those things. Okay, so signs, robes, weapons, and belts. Belts is strength, which goes with the defense. Sacrifices and solemn oath, which those two are what we'll talk about today through the Mosaic Covenant. So as we look at the Mosaic Covenant, we're going to look at the holiness that God is going to display of himself, but also of these people that he's bringing out. So he prepares them for holiness, and he prepares them for holiness the same way he prepared Abraham. And that is, remember when he called Abraham to go out, what does he say first to do?
Leave,
right? Leave off something. And that's what he does with the people of Israel, bringing them out of Egypt and bringing them to Mount Sinai. It takes them 3 months to get to Mount Sinai. Now, it should have taken them 3 months to get to Israel, but it takes them 3 months to get to Sinai. But there's a purpose in that. This is not the 40-year wandering where they were the instigators of having to wander 40 years. This is God's plan that he gives them 3 months, and he gives them 3 months with a lot of experiences so that they begin to understand that they need to take off the gods and the view of relationship with the divine that they have understood for the last 400 years, right? And what kind of a relationship with the divine have they taken in the last 400 years?
Transactional.
It's very transactional, right? It's feed the gods and they'll feed you. And so God is going to prepare them for holiness, to participate in holiness, by first having that space to take them off, to take that idea of a transactional divinity off. And he's going to provide for them as they move. Now, that's a big deal, because remember, the A&E people thought that gods had reign over just a certain area, right?
Yeah.
But now God's going to move them, and he's going to move them from Egypt, and in Egypt, they see God providing for them, right, with the plagues, and they see them defending them. They see God defending them in the plagues, because the plagues are going everywhere for the Egyptians, but not for the Israelites. And here it is, God is doing something in the lands of all these gods. And then God moves them, and he moves them to the Red Sea, and he defends them again, where it looks like they're trapped, and he opens up the sea, and he not only brings them across on dry land, but he also drowns all of their enemies. And now they see God providing for them, defending that they're his. Remember, because that's what Moses has to keep saying. Let my people go. Let my people go. And what is great about that is it's not so much for Pharaoh, but it's for the Israelites to hear, my people, my people. These are my people. You let them go. And so he shows them, you're my people. I'm going to defend you. And I'm going to defend you in all different places. So in Egypt, but now crossing the Red Sea, I'm going to defend. In reality, all of these places would have been belonged to other gods. Right, is what they understood. Mm-hmm. And now they're learning, what's with this God? He moves with us. Like, that's odd. That was never understood in the ancient Near East terms. So he gets to see them defend that they're his. He also gets to see them to defend they're his when they, now God purposely does this. He brings them into the desert and they have no water. Now, we would think, well, why didn't God just supply them with water at the very beginning? But what does it do for them when they have no water and then God supplies it in miraculous ways?
Dependence.
Yeah, completely dependent, seeing, oh, this God actually cares for us. Like, did they do anything to get the water? What did they do about, they complained and grumbled, and God gives them water. Now, wait a second, that's not supposed to happen, right? In a transactional deity-humanity relationship, that doesn't happen. You complain? Fine, die, right? So they, what's happening in this 3 months traveling is they are getting to see God move with them, God providing for them, God defending them and providing for them without them providing for him. So there be, do you see this learning curve that's happening for them? So that he actually defends when they cry out, He brings them their provision. But in all of those times that he's traveling with them and bringing them, what goes before them?
The pillar of cloud.
Right, the fire and the cloud, right? Mm-hmm. So that they understand this God actually is moving with us, right? They see, they understand that as some sign of God's presence. And so what's beginning to happen is that Israel begins to learn that God's presence is actually essential to who they're going to be. And so from here on in, we're going to think about presence. That's why Abraham was told, I'm your shield. Look, I'm with you. And now his descendants are beginning to understand that his presence is actually essential to who they're going to be, who they're going to become. What they also see is that God is valuing them, right? He actually cares about them. And because of who they've been, they've formerly been, what was their status formerly?
Slaves.
Who are worthless, right? Except as machines. That's all. So they're not valued as human beings. They're valued as machines only. And now this God seems to actually value them as human beings. And that's a huge switch for them. That's like, how is this? What kind of a God is this? I want you to think about a woman who has only known men's attention because they can get sex from her. So think about a woman that's been her life experience. The only time they get attention from men is because they know that they can have sex from them. And then a man comes to them and starts to pay attention to them and opens the car door, comes when her car breaks down. Every evening he says goodnight to her without any expectation or push or anything about any sexual ovations. It won't be surprising if that woman doesn't quite trust it, right? Mm-hmm. Because all she has known, her experience only, is a transactional relationship. That's just how men and women are. And I would say that there's a lot of women today that really, they might not say it, but that's how they feel, is that's all the relationship between men and women really are. You want something from me. And that's all they know, so that when they encounter someone who doesn't want a transaction, they don't quite trust it. Well, that's what Israel is like, right? Israel's lived for 400 years in this transactional relationship with the divine and with other people. And so it's why you can understand through this desert journey, they're not quite sure if this God could possibly be real. You know, they're almost waiting for, when are you going to want some from me? When do you want me to feed you? So God prepares them by he keeps on showing them, I'm giving you this. You're grumbling, I'm giving you this. You're grumbling again, I'm giving you this. You're grumbling again, I'm giving you this. And he's trying to show them what he's like so that they begin to trust him, so that they can become his people. And then he gives them a promise at the point where they just arrive at Sinai, and they give God gives Moses a promise, which is very interesting. Remember the promise that Abraham had been given by God. He said that your people would be enslaved for 400 years, but then they would come out, and he says, and I promise that they will have many possessions. And the interesting thing is how he fulfills that is, they get many possessions, but now they're learning that they will be a treasured possession. So that it opens up. That was just the beginning of, you're going to have lots of possessions, because right then that's all they could see is, oh, that would be a blessing. But now he's going, you've come out with lots of blessings, but now I'm going to make you into a treasured possession. You will be a possession. You won't just have possessions. You will be a treasured possession. And we have this bad connotation about that. I'm not a possession of anybody. But in that culture, to be a treasured possession, remember, means the king was honoring you with a partnership. Like, that's huge. For them to begin to recognize that that's who God is calling them. That's what God wants to confer on them. So he has this promise to Moses. In Exodus 19, he tells them, if you indeed obey my voice, listen to my voice, and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession, the treasured possession, among all the people, for all the earth is mine. and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So what he does is he says, I'm going to invite you into a covenant, into a relationship. They understand what a covenant is. They understand that it's a relationship. And in that relationship, I'm going to confer on you a new status. And the new status is going to be treasured possession. And then even more, it's going to be a holy nation and a royal priesthood. These are the things I'm going to confer on you. I'm going to give you a new status once you are in relationship with me, once you're in a covenant relationship with me. And the people respond with, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So if they're that woman, and this man has been kind to them over months and months and months, just continuing to be kind for them, asking nothing from them, when the man says, I'm going to give you a new status, and the woman says, well, yeah, great, this will be great. I'm no longer a prostitute. I am now going to be a married woman, basically. That's kind of the kind of idea. And of course they say, we do. And if this is what Israel says. Yes, we want that new status. We don't want to be slaves anymore. It's great that you're going to give us a new status. We want that, definitely. And so they're acknowledging that they want it. And they're acknowledging that it comes with some kind of responsibility. A new status always comes with a new responsibility, right? Yeah, we'll do that. We'll take on that responsibility. But the truth is that they have no idea what that responsibility is, right? Somebody who's been a prostitute their whole life have no idea what it's going to look like to be a married woman. And the responsibility of a covenant relationship in marriage is going to look a lot differently than the covenant the responsibility as a prostitute, right? Mm-hmm. Very different. So they have no idea what they're actually agreeing to, but they should begin to understand that they're going to need help with it, right? Because they don't know. They've never been in a transformational relationship. And that's what Israel is going through. These are the ways that the writer wants you to understand Israel. As a woman who's been a prostitute all her life, and now she's being invited into a different kind of thing. What they've also understood through their desert journey is that there's no way they're going to be able to accomplish what God is calling them to. There's no way they're going to be able to take on this status without being in relationship with God, right? There's no way, because they don't know how to do it. It's like being a parent for the first time, and no one is around for you to be a parent, and you've maybe grew up in an orphanage. How would that be? It would be so impossible, right? You'd have to reach out to ask somebody, how am I going to be a parent? It's that kind of an idea. So they know and they understand that as a community, they're being readied to don God's holiness on them, God's personhood, who God is, this relationship with God, his life that is given out for the other. So what they've begun to understand is this God, this Yahweh, all he does is give out. He's just always giving out. And that's this great progression that they begin to see is we grumble and he just gives. We grumble and he just gives. And they begin to see he's calling us to be people that are partnering with him. How are we ever going to learn how to just give out? Because what have they learned for 400 years? Right? I got to hold on. Because in a transactional relationship, you don't give anything extra. You give what you think you're going to get. And now this God is calling them into partnership, into a life that's always giving out for the other. How am I going to possibly know how to do that?
They've been living a life of scarcity because they've been slaves.
Yes. Exactly.
Right. Like we don't.
Right.
That.
Exactly. Exactly.
And now it's like, you're gonna live in abundance.
Right.
And we provide
right. Exactly. So I love to look at the stories that way, because we tend to look at those stories as, oh, those stupid Israelites, right? Those stiff-necked people. But really, because this is a story about God, God's saying, yes, you've lived in scarcity, but I'm going to show you what life of abundance looks like, and I'm going to teach you how to give abundantly. And then he's going to give them a provision for participating in that kind of a life, in that kind of holy perichoretic relationship. And the provision he's going to give are the Ten Commandments. And we'll talk about that in a minute, because I have here down here the ten words. We'll tell you why in a second. So in Exodus 19, so one of the things, she had you read just a little piece of the Sinai Covenant. I wish we had time to, well, maybe we have time to read some of it. 19:10. Let's look at Exodus 19:10. Somebody read 10 through 18.
I can do it, but I have NIV.
That's fine.
You prefer it in ESV?
That's fine.
And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death. They are to be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on them. No person or animal shall be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they may approach the mountain." After Moses had gone down to the mountain to the people, he consecrated them and they washed their clothes. Then he said to the people, "Prepare yourselves for the third day. Abstain from sexual relations. On the morning of the third day, there was a thunder and a lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently."
Okay. I hope that now you're beginning to pick out words and phrases that should remind you of other things, right? I hope that that's what's happening here. One of the words that is used often over and over again here is the word consecration, right? It says, consecrate yourself, consecrate yourself, consecrate yourself. I think it says it four times. So that the first thing that for them to come and meet, remember, the whole purpose of them being let go from Egypt, what was Moses to tell Pharaoh? Let my people go so that they can
worship
me. Now they're at that point. They've come to the mountain where they're going to worship God. But in order for them to do so, he first says you have to consecrate yourself. You have to be ready. And to be ready to consecrate yourself, that word consecrate is actually be holy. It actually means to dedicate yourself, your attention to God who is in front of you, right? To dedicate yourself to that. But he tells them one of the ways they're to concentrate themselves is to wash their clothes. Interesting here. So if you're told to wash your clothes, what's the first thing you have to do when you to
take them off?
You have to take them off, right? So you have to take them off. And the word they use here for wash is actually to trample, which I love. So he says, take off your clothes and trample them. And then basically put on new clothes, right? Wash clothes. Clothes that are new, no longer slave clothes, but now different clothes, right? So it's this metaphor of you're putting on a new robe because you're coming to a place that you're going to have a new status put on you, and you're going to be revealed to who this God is. The second thing he says three times is be ready for what?
The third day.
Okay, did that not prick your ears? Mm-hmm. Right? Be ready for the third day. And he says it three times. Be ready for the third day. In fact, there's an inclusio here that you'll see. He says it once and twice, and we look at all that stuff in between. So third day is used a lot through Scripture. Third day, literally used, means that you're to look for something really special that will happen. So when it talks about 3 days, it's always the third day is like there is something out of the ordinary going to happen. So we think about third day, and what's the first thing you think about when you hear third day?
Resurrection,
right? But it's been building all along that when you hear on the third day, oh, something really amazing is going to happen. So be prepared for the third day. So when they say that, they know something amazing is going to happen. Something really wonderful is going to happen on this third day, and they're to be ready for that. And then they're to be ready in recognition. So then we have the thunder and lightning come, and it talks about fire and the smoke of a furnace. Did that remind you of anything? Probably because you're translation.
Old learners.
What? No, 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 no. So you've been looking at the Abrahamic covenant, right? And you have this. Yeah, the smoking pot. Yeah, same thing, right? So we have this fire and the smoking pot. So it should bring up, oh, those are symbols of God, right? Fire and smoke are symbols of God. We've seen the symbol of God. They've seen the symbol of God, not just in the Abrahamic covenant, but their whole journey right now, right? Because by day and by night, what's leading them? Fire and cloud, fire and smoke. If you trace that throughout Scripture, you'll see that over and over again. Fire and smoke, fire and smoke. We get into the New Testament, and we see fire where?
On the heads of the Holy Spirit.
Right, the Holy Spirit on Pentecost, right? We see that. So it goes throughout. So when you see these types of things, you've got to keep in mind, wait, somewhere else I've seen fire and smoke. Somewhere else I've seen it. And it will keep on going on. So they are supposed to recognize this thunder and lightning, this fire and smoke that come on the mountain. Oh, this is God's presence. God's presence is here. That's what they've been seeing all along. And now it's exponentially bigger. And this whole mountain is filled with his presence. And then with that, the first thing that happens is that God gives Moses what we call the Ten Commandments. Now, I'm going to pull back on that, and I want you to stop calling them the Ten Commandments. Because first of all, it's never said that. Actually, what it says is it's the Ten Words. And the reasons we need to know that is because this, again, is an echo. And this is something I actually mentioned at the beginning, but you won't remember. But there have been Ten Words before. Does anybody know where? good guess. Yep. Genesis 1, and God said, 10 times God says and puts creation in order, right? And so what we have here is this echo of God beginning creation again, God restoring order again. So when we talk about it, this is what happens. Whenever we take and we try to translate things so that we understand them better, then we lose a little bit, and we lose a little bit. And you'll see that as we talk about some of the practices we go through. Every time we change those to make it supposedly relevant for us, we begin to lose some of that stuff. So when we call them the Ten Commandments, we lose that. And in reality, when people who know A&E stuff, they recognize that the 10 words here is just a description of the whole Torah. It's a description of instructions of God. Remember, Torah means instructions. When we say law, which is how we usually translate it, we immediately think about something different than what it is. So what would be the difference between law and instructions? When you think about that, if someone says...
Instructions are like life-giving and law is like punishment.
Yeah, right. I mean, law is very stringent, right? It's this or else. These are actually instructions. It's actually the word Torah, and Torah means instructions or words or conversation.
In instructions, there's order. When you think about cooking instructions.
Exactly.
You have to
get in order. Right. Law is almost like, who was saying something about, it's either just do it because I told you so, right? That's law. Or here's how you do this so that you can make a cake. Right? Okay. So I want us to begin to think about the fact that these are the 10 words. They are instructions from Yahweh. They're Torah. And they're given as an echo of Genesis 1. I'm putting in order again so that The whole idea of order for the world, for the earth, is so that man can live in right relationship with God. So that we begin to see this in a different light. So what he's doing here, when he gives the Ten Commandments, or see, ten words, and when he gives all of the Torah here, as we think about that, and it goes on for chapter after chapter after chapter, he's giving them guidelines for maintaining access to God's presence. So remember, he's already said, he's already shown them narratively, my presence is important for you. In fact, it's necessary for you to be able to take on this new status. So here are some instructions so that you can learn how to live in my presence, in the presence of a God who is holy, in the presence of a God who continually gives himself out completely and who takes in the other completely. So that Israel, because Israel has no idea how to live a life that isn't transactional. They've only known prostitution, and they don't know what it would take for a marriage. Here's what it's not. It's not a matching game. God doesn't say, look, I'm holy, now try to match me. Would that even be possible?
No.
He never says that. It's be holy. And the word be holy is actually join my holiness, participate in my holiness, not try hard, strive hard to be perfect, which is how we take it, right? Be holy as I am holy. No, enter, participate in my holiness. You don't know how to do that? So I'm going to give you some contextually appropriate instructions of how to do that. So that it will help you maintain your new status. So it will help you be able to live in this way. So that Torah becomes revelation rather than legislation. We so often think about this as legislation. And if you're reading this from an A&E point of view, really, as you read these documents, you understand it isn't legislation. If you were reading them as an A&E people, you would understand that. These are just examples of way you could actually reflect your God. These are just some ways that you could do that. They are means of revealing who God is, but also means of you being able to reflect who God is, for you being a revelation of who God is, for you able to practice as a community something of what God looks like, right? Some approximation of what God looks like. In other words, it's helping these unsophisticated former prostitutes become really fulfilled wives. How many of you ever saw the old movie Pretty Woman? Remember it? So for those of you who haven't seen it, Pretty Woman is about a prostitute, right? And she accidentally goes to answer a call. Well, she doesn't accidentally. He doesn't know that he's calling a prostitute. He thinks he's calling some, I don't know what he thinks. Yeah, she's going to do errands for him or something. Anyway, he falls in love with her. And for the whole movie, he's trying to teach her her value and how you live as someone who's valuable. He loves her. He doesn't want her for sex. He loves her. And so he takes pains about teaching her how it is you behave as someone who's valuable as a partner, as a wife. Eventually they get married at the end, right? Mm-hmm. He gives her a ring at the end. But there's some funny scenes there, right? Because she has no idea. So she doesn't know how to dress, right? She thinks, well, how did I dress the prostitute? And he's like, no. This doesn't tell you that you're valuable. This is just the opposite. And then he says, there's a place where they go to the races, right? And he teaches her how you would behave within society of people who feel they're valuable. And so all along the whole movie, he's teaching her how to understand that she's valuable and what that looks like, how you reflect that in your behavior. That's the idea of the 10 words. That's the idea of God giving them, look, you don't know you're valuable, but here are ways that you can you can begin to reflect the fact that I've said you're my treasured possession, that I'm bringing you into my holy relationship here, and you can avoid being out of order. That's really what the 10 words are there for, as God begins to reveal himself through those. So the first thing about Torah, about the 10 words, is that it's a revelation about who God is. So we see the first three commandments are about God, about how you would relate to God. So if we're talking Pretty Woman, and Richard Gere is trying to remind her of how you would relate to him, right? So he would say, you talk to me this way. You don't use your body in the wrong way. You talk to me this way. That shows that I value you and you value me. It shows a relationship. And then the last six commandments are about how you would relate to others, right? So she doesn't have to just learn how she relates to Richard Gere in there, right? It's Julia Roberts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have to just learn how to relate to him. She now also has to learn how to be in the world and relate to others. That's what the last of those ten, the last six of those commandments are, is how you would relate to others. To reflect that you are in a relationship that says you're valuable, and that the person who says you're valuable is somebody who loves people and gives out. And the middle commandment is the Sabbath commandment, which is the longest commandment. It's like four verses long. And it says, make a habit of making space to remember who God is so that you can continue in this kind of reflective living. So make space. So it would be as if Richard Gere would say, every Wednesday we have a date night so that you remember that that this relationship is good. Mm. And that you remember who I am. I'm your husband, not your pimp or not your paid John, whatever it is. But that I'm your husband, that I'm giving out to you because I love you. That's the idea of Sabbath. Does this make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Torah is revelation. It is how to live in right relationship with God, with others, and to make a habit every week so that you stop and think, this is a good relationship. This is who God is. That God is holy, and that living in his holiness is what I'm called to. So that is God preparing Israel for holiness, providing for a way to be in that holy relationship. And now we have this commitment to holiness. So Exodus 24. And I think this is what she had you read, right, in the homework. This is that ceremony here. So somebody read 1 through 5, and then the next person reads 6 through 11.
Then he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him. Then Moses came and commanded to the people all the words of the Lord, and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken we will do. Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. He sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord.
Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant, which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they saw God, and they ate and drank.
Okay, so let's go through this. It might seem like an odd ceremony, but when we pick it apart, you're going to see how familiar the ceremony is. So first of all, we have, this is obviously the ceremony of commitment to the covenant. We have, first of all, this mediation to confer status. So Moses is there in order to confer status to them, in order to confer to them that they're going to be not only treasured possession, but his holy people. So because they've had to consecrate over and over again, because of the repetition of the word holy, we know that that's what's happening here, is he's conferring on them a status of holy nation. You're going to be a holy nation. I'm conferring the status on you now. And Moses is the mediator to give that, right, to confer that. So Moses comes from Yahweh, comes down, and he tells the people the words of the Lord. And the people vow their faithfulness, right? Yes, we agree to that. And then Moses writes down all the words and builds an altar at the foot of the mountain. So there we have this mediation of, we're getting ready to confer this status on you. And then we have the oath. And the oath is the ceremony here about the blood. I apologize for that. So this ceremony is actually the mirror of the ceremony that God had with Abraham, which we still haven't completely talked about. We'll talk about a little bit more today. It's the mirror of that. And the reason it doesn't look exactly like that is because instead of just Abraham and God, there's God and 1 million people. So you got to do it a little bit differently. So Israel makes sacrifices. And those sacrifices there are a sign of commitment to give their life to God, right? You've told us that you're going to make us a holy nation, a treasured possession. Yes, we want to do that. That's that sacrifice there. We want to do that. We'll give our lives to you. We'll give over our lives to you. And it's the equivalent then of the Abrahamic covenant. So what we have is Moses taking the blood from those sacrifices, right, and dividing them in two, right? So he takes the blood and puts one part in the basins and one part on the altar. So there's the dividing in half that happens with the Abrahamic covenant, right? So that animals get divided in half. So now we're dividing the blood in half in the basin. And the word basin there is actually vessel, and that's always used for humanity. So the basin is the picture of the people of Israel. And then, of course, the altar is a picture of God, right? So we have them divided in half. And then we have Moses sprinkling them, right, on the Book of the Covenant, which again is symbolizing God, and the people. He sprinkles on the people. So this is their walk through the two pieces. Because how are you going to get 1 million people to walk through the blood of those animals, right? By the time the 100th person walks through, the blood is dried and it's not effective as a picture. But think about it. It's really effective if you get sprinkled with blood, right? If I'm sprinkling you with blood, like, that stays with you. Like, that is a memory. And one of the reasons it's a memory is not just the visual. It's they understood blood as life, right? And they understood that something died. But also the smell, right? The smell of blood is, yeah. It is yucky, right? But that's necessary for our memories. So this ceremony is, there's a very visual and, I don't know about auditory, but there's
visceral,
that's the word, visceral. It's a very visceral picture of them walking through the pieces. And they would have understood that. They would have understood that that's, oh yeah, we're cutting covenant here. And we're walking through the pieces with them. And then Moses reads the Book of the Covenant, and people vow their faithfulness again, and that's when Moses sprinkles the people with the blood. And then there's this pronouncement of covenant relationship, right? Behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. And then we have a sealing of that commitment with the meal. And so the representatives, the 70... what is it called? The nobles of the sons of Israel, the 70 representatives plus Moses and his entourage come and eat a meal in the presence of God. Like, huge. They eat a meal. Remember again, A&E thought, the only thing that you have to do with meat is you give it to the gods to eat. You never eat with God. And remember, we talked about eating a meal, I think last week. Eating a meal is sharing life together, right? And there's this huge thing of Israel is going to share life with God. And of course, there's representatives, because again, a million people, you're not gonna have all a meal with God in God's presence. So there's a representative there. And then in verse 12, Moses actually leaves for a while again. So the mediator of this covenant left for a while. So let's think about this. Does that sound like a familiar ceremony to you?
Jesus. That's what I thought. And then he leaves for a while. What?
Yeah, right. So we definitely know it's a type of Christ, right? Before we even get to the type of Christ, is there any ceremony you know that you've probably been a part of that looks like this? Yes, a wedding. It looks like a wedding because it is a wedding. That's exactly what happens on Mount Sinai, is God is committing to a marriage partnership with Israel. So let's think about some of the practices we have in weddings. And remember what I said, the more we want to make things relevant for us, the farther away we get from the beautiful symbolism that brings us back to that. So most of you will know a lot of these wedding practices, but nowadays the wedding practices have gotten so far away from biblical covenant relationship that we don't see these anymore. But you'll be familiar with them if you watch old movies, I suppose, or you're as old as I am. Walking between the pieces. Where do you see that in a wedding?
You walk between the two down the aisle, between the two families.
Right, exactly. So when you walk down the aisle, that's the whole purpose of that. So that's why the groom side sits on one and the bride side sits on the other. So it's walking between the two pieces of flesh, right? The flesh of the husband and the flesh of the wife. So again, we make it relevant and we say, oh, people should just sit where they want. And that's great, but now you're walking back a little bit and you're losing a little bit of that picture of walking between the pieces. There's a mediator that actually directs what's going on, right? And gives the words, right? They give a sermon, they ask for the vows, right? There's a mediator there, the pastor or the priest, whoever is marrying the couple. There's an oath, just like here, there's an oath. And although the oath no longer says this, this is what the oath used to say. Do you promise to love her, comfort her, honor, and keep her for better, for worse, for richer, poorer, in sickness and health, and forsaking all others until death do you part? Be faithful only to her for as long as you both shall live. Sure sounds a lot like what's going on here, right? That's exactly what is going on here. The oath of, yes, we're going to be faithful to this relationship, that this will be our husband, and this will be that type of a relationship. The making of sacrifices, the giving of something valuable to say, I'm giving my life to you. Where do we find that in a wedding ceremony? The exchanging of rings, right? I'm giving you my life, you're giving me yours, as a seal of that vow, to remember the goodness of that vow and the promise I've made in that vow. And then, of course, there's a pronouncement, right? In fact, when you do a wedding as the officiant, there are basically only two things you have to say. You have to ask them if they take this person. No matter what word you say, you have to ask them. It's legally, this is what you have to do. You have to ask them that. And you have to pronounce that they're husband and wife. So those are the only two things legally you have to do in a wedding ceremony. And that happens, right? But that comes out of covenant. That's not like something that, you know, the United States made up. That's actually coming out of covenant. There is this pronouncement of a new relationship. I now pronounce you husband and wife. And then, most of the times, after a wedding, what happens? You share a meal, right? There's this celebratory meal. And that's what we have here. So don't think we Americans came up with this great idea of having a wedding this way. This is actually how covenant works. And that's what we see happening in the Sinai covenant. And of course, you mentioned, Lord Jean, that this looks like Christ, right? That Jesus makes it possible for us to be in union with God, right? He's the mediator there. He confers on us a new status, right? We're called the bride of Christ. And there is a celebratory meal. What's the celebratory meal? The Lord's Supper. And we'll talk about that even more. So why don't you put your pencils down, your papers down. I want you to get out your car keys. And if you don't have your car keys with you, I want you to, first question. So these they're just little pieces of paper, and I want you to write on them, but they have one sticky part at the end. So be careful not to touch on that sticky part because that needs to be able to be sticky.
I have extra keys if anyone wants
them. So if you don't have your keys with you, I want you to think about your house. If you have your house keys with you or your garage code or the way to get into your house, I want you to put on this little piece of paper, if you have your car keys, I want you to describe your car so we know which one it is. So it has to be the one that you have
here.
So if it's a red Nissan Sentry, then write that down. If you don't have your car keys with you and you walked over here, put your garage code down and your address. So if you don't have your car keys with you, so for those who walked here or were driven, I want you to put your address down and your either garage code, how to get in, or where you hide your key, however it is, so that somebody can get in your house. So when you do that, I want you to put that around your car keys so that, because you're going to put your car keys in a pile here. And I want you to identify your car keys. And for Robin, you'll just have a sheet of paper. Yep. Pat, you'll have a sheet of paper. Yep, just like that. And then as soon as you do that, just come and put your car keys or your in a pile here.
Diane, I want to find your new take in a pile.
Is it okay to cover her car? Because I do.
If you were a group of men, there would just be all peacocks, but you've got all this dangly stuff.
That's funny. You know, I've actually been thinking about that because at night. So I'm concerned at night that the guys won't want to give up their keys.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking, like, there's going to be some more hesitation. Do that. So particularly when I tell you what we're going to do with them. So now what I want you to do is I want you to come and take somebody else's.
I think it's a cute one.
So remember, some of them are just papers, and that means you get their house, right?
Oh, wow, this is the...
But
well,
I
need
a different vehicle to drive home with now. Of course. I think so far I have a very similar car, but just different color.
That's good, because I don't want mine to be the only one in the group. I'm going to end up with mine.
Okay, everybody has Everybody has either car keys or the way to get into somebody's house.
Woohoo!
Yep. Party this weekend. Party this weekend, ladies, at 5:18.
So for the week, you now get to use that person's car or house. So before you leave...
How will I get there if I don't have my car?
Pat, you have two cars. So here you go. I want you to look at who has your keys. So put them up and kind of see who has your keys.
White Toyota Highlander.
Angela, are these
mine?
Oh, yes.
I told you, please, I'm going to kill your car.
You are so cute.
Okay, so take note of who has it. Okay, so before you go ahead with borrowing each other's stuff, I want to ask you, is there anything you want to tell the person that has your car keys or house?
We need gas.
My steering wheel is heated.
Anything else?
The dog.
Footprints. Like Carson yes, nose prints.
Oh, I have one.
It really needs to be on the side.
Notice that when you're giving something that's valuable to someone else to use, first of all, do I even dare ask how many of you are a little bit nervous?
No, I agree. I'm nervous
that you're actually giving someone your car to use for a week or your house to use for a week. Is there...
Am I still in my house? Or do I have to get out?
You have to get out.
I'm giving up the comfort of what I have.
That doesn't quite seem like a fair trade.
Okay, so if that's true, if you're now going to somebody's house,
just the two of us. It's,
right.
It's a bigger thing.
Yes, Chris.
I was a little nervous because when I realized a little maybe what you were doing, I put my house keys away and just grabbed my car. Because I get those keys. So I'll be honest.
Yeah, and that's what I want to hear. Is because it would be natural for us to go, okay, wait. And I know most of you are going, she doesn't really mean it. And there's one or two of you are going,
I hope she did.
Right?
I would have cleaned my car first.
But
there's a lot more than a car key here.
Yeah, there's a lot.
A whole stack of them. I have no idea.
So you're giving something valuable. First of all, it's hard to give you that. But also, you kind of want to make sure they take care of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like if there's if it has just a little wonky way to steer, you want to tell them that, right? Mm-hmm. Like just so you know. Mm-hmm. The steering wheel is just a little, so you got to do this, right? Mm-hmm. That's one of the first things you're going to say. Because you want them to protect it, right? It's valuable. You want something, you want them to make sure that they take care of it. You also want to say it needs gas because running out of gas is not really good for your car. You want to protect them as well, right? Mm-hmm. So you actually have a lot of instructions for them mm-hmm. because you want to protect what's valuable. For both them and you, right?
Mm-hmm. But also, one person shared a way they could enjoy it more.
So, in
a relationship,
exactly.
You
know,
you want to point out, well, if you have my house, be sure and do this because you will just love it.
Right.
So you turn on the fireplace.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And she said, I have a heated steering wheel. Make sure you use that if it's really cold today. That's the idea of what God is doing with Torah and with the covenant relationship. He's saying, I'm giving you my life, and it's holy. It's perichoretic. I want you to enjoy it, but I also want you to take care of it. I want you to make sure that it stays intact so that this idea of thinking of Torah as legislation or of you've got to do this or else, you're not thinking that with what you've just taken away, right? You're saying, I want you to protect it because it is valuable, right? There's a lot that went into buying a car or a house, but I also want you to enjoy it too, and here's the best way to enjoy it. And maybe, like Pat is getting car keys, but she's giving away a house. So now she's going to have to say, hey, whoever car keys I have, can I come live with you? Or, you know, there's going to have to be this, can we do this together? If I gave my car keys away and I have no car now, if I gave up car keys and I got a house, but you have no car now, mm-hmm. now there's going to be some, well, can we do this together? right, exactly. So there's all of these nuances about what God is doing in covenant and in this marriage proposal that he gives Israel. So when we think about Sinai, we've got to stop putting it in this category of God says you have to do this or you're out. He does say protect it. Appreciate it. Enjoy it. But you can only enjoy it if you're using it right. Correct? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe some of you have the question of, like, what if before I had you do the keys, I had you raise your hand to see if you'd ever gotten a ticket. And then, and let's say three people raised their hands, and you said, what'd you get a ticket for? Speeding. And then we gave the car keys, and you see that that person got your car keys. How do you feel now? You want to talk to her, right? Hey, could you be careful with the car? You know, don't go over the speed limit. Right? You're not trying to make her match your holiness. You're trying to say this is valuable. Let's protect it. Let's treat it as valuable. Does that make sense to you? I hope that gives you a different idea of what God is doing here with the covenant. And then we can talk about the solemnity of covenant, how serious it is, covenant, right? It was kind of serious for you to give somebody their car, right? And, you know, I toyed with, like, what would this happen if I actually
really
make you do this?
Like
for a whole day? Like, weird. How would this go, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason I wouldn't do it is because I know my husband. And I'm guessing most of your husbands are like, what in the heck are you doing? Right? Yeah.
What I think about is everything I have to get out of my car before I actually give it to you.
But here's an interesting thing, right? That's another piece of it. Like, God is giving you his holy life. Does he need to take some stuff back so that he can use it and you can't? Or, like he says, I give you it all. I give you it all. Use whatever's in there, you know. Who left their purse in there? Edie, your purse is in there? Yeah, go ahead and... This is what God is saying, right? I'm giving you my car and my purse is in there too. Go ahead and use it. Right? Right? That's a whole different thing.
And it's use it for good to reveal his holiness.
Exactly.
Not whatever
exactly.
We want to do.
Right? And so as you're driving around, so whoever upgraded, Lisa upgraded, who got Diane's car? So Alex, did you upgrade? Okay.
That goes with three grandchildren. That's why I have that car.
But you guys upgraded, and when somebody says, wow, where'd you get the new car? What do you say? It's Diane's. It's Diane's car, right? Not, yeah, I bought it. Yeah, I thought I deserved a new car.
Yeah.
Plus, I think I'd be extra cautious if I
know. Yeah.
I'd be so worried that something would happen.
Right. Yes, you would. Yeah. You would be absolutely.
Or, you
would
know,
take better.
You know, even if I did get your car, I'd want my car. You know, it's just
okay, interesting, right? Because that's is what Israel does a lot, right? I'd rather have Egypt.
Well, we all didn't just get a car. We gave something up, so there was both happening.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
It plays out differently, but.
So you can decide whether you're going to take this car or not. Don't give it back right now. I'll have you pray about it and think through it.
I'm trying to continue in this example. Like, I have Linda's information, and if I just let it fall somewhere, I'm like, but this information is, like, God wants everyone to be part of coming to the home. But we're also to protect it too. I'm
correct, right? Right. You wouldn't just drop it. But if you were to share it, like if you're, and this would be great, right? You decide, oh, I'm going to have all the kids from youth group over to my new home that I'm using for a week, right? And how you have them over, first of all, you say, this is not my home. This is Linda's home. Let's make sure we treat it correctly. And isn't that a gift that she would give us this space? Right?
Yeah.
You don't just say, you know, just drop it up. Yeah, that would be really bad if you dropped, or if any of you dropped this on your way out, right? I actually dropped my keys yesterday. I didn't drop it. It came off of my thing and didn't even realize it. And I'm walking back through the parking lot to put the cart away, and I see this key fob. And I think, oh, look, somebody left a key fob on the ground. I did. And I went to pick it up and went, that's mine. Oh. But if it would have my information on it, if it would have said what car it was, bad news, right? Mm-hmm. So you're right, Lord Jean. We have to think about when we're invited into God's holiness, that's a privilege that we're to take care of well, right? That's the whole idea of what God calls us into covenant. So when we come into this covenant relationship, we have to take care of that relationship well. So let's get into now the seriousness of covenant, because that has to do with all of that. It was serious for you to give your car away or your house away. But in covenant, you're giving your life, and he's giving his life to us. So the seriousness of marriage then, since it's a marriage covenant, was what we're talking about in Sinai. There is an oath of faithfulness, right? So we have to talk about what an oath is. An oath is a promise that's accompanied by valuable assurance, right? It's not just words. It's not just propositional truth. It's accompanied with something valuable. In other words, you put up meaningful collateral. And that's why when I began to think, well, what is the most meaningful collateral we have in our lives today? Often it's our car or our house. Right? That's kind of a meaningful collateral. But the most meaningful collateral that we can put up is our life. Right? And in fact, Pat, exactly what you said, your pastor said, that's exactly what it is. When you come to a marriage, you're giving up your life. That's my collateral to say, I'm going to be faithful to this new relationship and to this new status. And it's this offer to say, take my life away if I'm not faithful to this relationship. And that's the idea of the seriousness, the solemnity of a covenant. It always bothers me, and I've had to talk to many pastors when a church, a neighborhood, whatever says, we're going to make a covenant and we're going to have everybody sign it. And I'm like, wait a second. They have no idea how serious a covenant is. They have no idea that when they commit to a covenant, they're saying, if I break it, may God take my life away. Mm-hmm. So to have a neighborhood covenant just bothers me. Like, no, you don't know what you're asking here. And a lot of churches have people sign covenants, and I'm like, I'm in covenant with God, and the only reason I'm in covenant with God is because he's going to make sure that it's not broken. But man, when you're asking me to make a covenant with man, that makes me nervous. And in a marriage, that covenant, that promise is, I'm going to give up my independent life in exchange for a new status, a status that's a two-into-one kind of a status, a promise to forsake all others, that this is the most important relationship I have. The word oath is the word sacrament in Latin. So when we think about the sacraments, those are actually oaths. Those are reminders of the oath that we have entered into, that God has allowed us to enter into. So most of our churches have only two sacraments. The Catholic Church has more. All of them, whether they're the seven Catholic ones or the two from ours. What are our two sacraments?
Baptism and
Lord's Supper. Yeah. So if you go to a Baptist church, you don't have sacraments. You don't believe in sacraments, but they're there nonetheless. So the Lord's Supper and baptism, but they both give point to the death of an independent life and new status of a joint life. That's what they both point to. So that you're making this promise to give up your independent life. So that when you did some of the study about what was happening in the New Testament church when people were taking the Lord's Supper in vain, right? Mm-hmm. And they were dying. Well, it's an oath. You're actually saying, I'm committed to this joint life, and if I'm living independently and I take it, I'm saying to God, God, kill me if I'm not committed to this dependent life, right? That's pretty serious. So the lives of a married couple from the day they're married on are to reflect a committed union, not two independent people. They're committed to uplifting one another, defending one another, sharing life with one another, not an independent life. The meal at the end is just the first standing up to say, this union is good. That's why the meal is there. That's why actually the meal usually for a marriage is kind of elaborate, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's just saying, this union is good. It's not so we can have a party. It's saying, I'm telling you, I'm standing here right now as a witness, this union is good. It's good for two people to become one. For independence to become dependence. And there's this acknowledgement of wanting to be involved in the other's life and giving up that independence. That is a picture of faith. So often we talk about faith as, oh, I believe. But that's so trite, and that's not what faith is. Faith, if you look up the word faith, pistis, or that's the Greek word. I can't think of the Hebrew word for it. It is to have knowledge of and assent to, agree, but in such a way that it actually produces in you a witness to say this is good. In other words, you can't have faith by saying I believe something and trusting it, but then never having anything in your life that says you trust it. If there are no good works, that's how New Testament says, if there's nothing to say this is a good union, then it isn't belief. Mm-hmm. I'll give you some more examples of that in a second. The worst trouble, so at the beginning of the class, the question was, what's the worst trouble you got in as a kid? What behavior? Well, in a marriage, what's the worst trouble for a marriage? Unfaithfulness, adultery, right? Unfaithfulness is the worst trouble that a marriage can have. It's false faith. It's false faithfulness. When I assent to something, when I agree, when I promise that, even when I go through the ceremony in a wedding, yes, I promise that, but I fail to take it seriously and I live recklessly independent. So unbelief is this continuing in independence. So I don't care if at some point you said those magic words, yes, I received Jesus into my heart, and you continue to live independently, there wasn't faith. It is all about a coming together in dependence, not continually independent, and instead just saying, I believe that what Jesus died for me. It isn't just an assent of a truth. It has to actually have, it actually changes your life because your status has now been changed. It begins with independence. Unfaithfulness begins with independence. And it begins to say, I'm just as whole without my partner as I am with my partner. I can have just as full of life without him as with him. I don't need to share my strengths, my defenses, and my life. It doesn't necessarily need to involve another person. So unfaithfulness doesn't have to involve another person. So when we're talking spiritually, it doesn't necessarily have to involve a very specific idol, because unfaithfulness can be done with omission or commission. When you are unattentive to the covenant partner as being part of you. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You jeopardize the marriage. Unfaithfulness to a life dedicated to the spouse says that the spouse isn't all that great. Like, I'm sure that you've seen marriages where the two get married and they just basically have separate lives, right? I mean, I've known a lot of people who one of them gets this great job somewhere else and the rest, they don't want to move. And so the spouse lives somewhere else. And I always, if they're a friend of mine, I always say, I'm telling you, this is dangerous for your marriage. And several times I've seen it end in divorce. Because you cannot, in a marriage, live faithfully with one another apart from one another. It has to be a shared life. Now, obviously, there are times where that's...
where it has to happen.
Where it has to happen.
But it's hard.
But it's hard, right?
It's hard, and you need lots of...
Right. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. But there's also ways that we live in our society where we say we want to live together, but we don't want the commitment, right? Mm-hmm. It won't work because there has to be this commitment of I'm giving you my life. It's not we're bringing two lives together and we just share the benefits and not the commitment. There's two ways of that are obvious of wanting a benefit from marriage, from a covenant relationship, but not the commitment. One is a benefit of a legal status. So I have a friend whose sister actually married a South African man in order for the South African man to be able to stay here. His visa was up. He couldn't stay here anymore. So she married him. He was a friend, and she married him. Now, that was a marriage for the benefit of legal status. I also know of a family member. They had no intention of living together, husband and wife. They got married, and they said, see ya. And they went off and lived together. I'll tell you what happened to that. I also have a family member who the man married the woman for the benefit of a social status. And he had no intention of ever consummating the marriage. So that he wanted people to think that he was married, but he had no intention of consummating that marriage. So that's a social benefit, right? So a marriage for benefit, but not a commitment to shared life. Both of those kinds of marriages are risky, right? Because they can either be annulled or they can be criminalized. And so, obviously, in the marriage where it was never consummated, the marriage was annulled within a month or two. The woman didn't know it, although there were warning signs. And she's like, what's this? So that marriage was annulled, divorced. There was a divorce there. The other one, where the woman married the man from South Africa, they got caught. That's illegal to do. And he was deported. And I don't know what... She could have had jail time for that. I don't think she did. But I do think there was a gigantic fine. So it's dangerous to have... Even in secular America, we don't stand for marrying for benefits only. Now, we hide that a lot. And I know that there are people that still do it. But that is not covenant. Covenant is a shared life, mm-hmm. not two independent lives that can benefit off one another. Mm-hmm. A covenant commitment is always a testimony to the goodness of perichoretic life. It's a testimony, which is why all the way in Genesis 1 or Genesis 2, it says, for this cause. What cause? To reflect the goodness of God's perichoretic life, to show how good it is to live completely for the other and the other completely for you. And that's flow that goes on. Marriage is a testimony to that. It's why marriage is so often used in the New Testament as a picture of God, because it shows this perichoretic idea. The way we live in a marriage is a witness. It's a testimony to the goodness of perichoretic life. When we live in such a way as to call into question the goodness of that relationship, then we're being unfaithful. We're calling God to publicly say, kill me. I have not witnessed the truth. I have not said that this covenant relationship is a good thing. It's good to be in there. Now, that doesn't mean, if you're married, it doesn't mean that you can't say this is hard, right? It's hard to be in a relationship with God. It does mean that you never say, this is horrible. I hate this. And when one of us continually is degrading the spouse, or if one of us is continually ignoring the spouse so that someone doesn't even know you're married, that's unfaithfulness. Mm-hmm. Now, translate it to your covenant relationship with God. If someone never knows you to use the name of Christ, to say, my Savior is so good. God has filled me. If they have never heard that from you, there's unfaithfulness there. Does that make sense? It's serious, guys. Our relationship with God is serious. We have entered into a relationship that is committed to a shared life. We have not entered into a relationship that is for the benefits only, which I just heard the other night, went out with old friends. And I heard someone say, you know, they just need to know that if they accept Christ, they can go to heaven. And I was just like, shut up, Jill. Don't say anything right now. That's the idea of a relationship for benefits only. Right? So we've got to be careful that what we're doing is giving a testimony to the goodness of perichoretic relationship, of shared life, and not giving testimony to, hey, I want you to ask Jesus into your heart so that you can go to heaven. And I don't want to think about that for me as well. I don't want to think about, am I only in relationship with God so that he can give me the benefits, right? That's not the idea of a covenant relationship. When I give false testimony, what is that called in court?
Perjury.
You're perjuring yourself. And when you're perjuring yourself, you're in contempt of court. And you either go to jail or get a fine. Even in our legal system, we say, testimonies are serious, right? In fact, I don't know how many of you have ever had to take an oath in court or a lie detector. Like, do you think, nothing to it? You're like, even though you know you're going to tell the truth, you're like, this is serious, right? I know that I could perjure myself here. I know that what I say is serious.
Be careful with your words.
Be careful with your words. And it is an oath, and it comes from this idea of covenant.
Well, even the, like, put your hand on the Bible. Which is silly when you think about it. Yeah, secular, like,
exactly. Yeah. So we have lots of these contextual ideas, right? So, and again, here's the weird thing. You know they don't do that in court anymore.
Don't.
No.
Oh, really?
Only on TV, huh?
Only on TV, wow. Yeah. So there's no Bible in court. So it used to be you put your hand on the, and this, right? That is
solemnly swear
to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. So help me God. That's the God, if I don't tell the truth, you can kill me. That's the idea of that.
The president does.
The president does. Yeah, right. So we do have a couple places that we still do the oath, and the president still does put his hand on a Bible. I'll bet you any money that goes away, because it's been, how long would you say it's been gone in court? A long time.
I don't know.
I mean,
do they still take an oath in court?
They just say, "Will you tell the truth?" Yes. It's like real. It's nonchalant.
There's no oath. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I will tell the truth.
Tell your own truth.
Yeah. Even kids have a way of doing this, right? Do you promise to be my friend forever? I promise. Cross my heart. Hope to die. Stick a needle in my eye. I don't know where that comes from.
Or you could be doing this.
Yeah, right. But think about that. Where did that come from? That came from covenant oaths. Cross my heart. Hope to die. If I fail to be your friend forever, whatever promise I've made. So all of these little remnants, and we're losing them, which tells you we're in a place of completely not recognizing who God is. But all of these came from the Aeonian ideas of covenant, of what how serious that is. Now what we do have after the things we read about Moses and Sinai, and God gives them the instructions for them to be able to be careful with the holiness that he's given them to participate in. Moses goes up, right, after the wedding ceremony, right? He leaves for a while. And like you said, just like Jesus, right, leaves for a while. And what? Now, remember, they've just had a wedding ceremony. What happens is when Moses goes up.
They get impatient.
They get impatient, right?
They're making an idol.
And they immediately become unfaithful. Yeah. Right after the wedding ceremony. Now think about that. I want you to put it in your head. You see this great wedding. It's beautiful. The priest leaves. They walk out. And the husband goes over to talk to his friend. And the woman is already talking to somebody else. And you're like, what's the deal? You just got married. You just made this oath. And so we have that happening with Israel and the golden calf, right? So that's what's happening there, and that's the context of it. God's response to that is, go away. Go to the land. I'm going to still give you the land because it's a promise I made, and I'm going to actually even help you get the land, but I'm not going with you. And Moses is like, what? If your presence doesn't go with us, we are no one. Your presence is essential for this status that you've given us, for our identity as image bearers. Your status is, your presence is essential for our value, right? You're the one husband who said we were valuable when we were prostitutes, and now you're saying you're not going to go with us? Why won't you go with us, God? And God says, because your life is telling a lie about me. Your life says that this relationship isn't good, that living paracritically isn't good. You're telling a lie. You're not saying I'm holy by the way you're behaving. So that if in the movie Pretty Women, if Julia Roberts marries Robert Gere and yet she continues to have pimps come in, what is she saying about Robert Gere?
Richard Gere.
Yeah. What is she saying about him?
He's
not very valuable. That's what's happening here with Israel. And that's why God says, my presence can't go with you because you're telling a lie about me. And when you tell a lie about me, when you say the relationship isn't valuable, how can you possibly go and continue being part of my plan? The plan is you're going to show the world how good this relationship is. But you're already telling them it isn't. So you can't participate in my plan. So how can I go live amongst you when that happens? It can't happen, right? I can't set up a sacred space. I can't set up a right relationship household without committing to a right relationship, without committing to a marriage. That's what's happening here. And so, of course, we have Moses interceding. And Moses says, God, we're nobody without you. We have no value without your presence. We need your presence here. We're not a people without it. And so, of course, Yahweh listens. And that's when we have the new writing of the words. God writes those words down. And in further revelation, and that's when Moses gets to see God. He says, the Lord your God is loving and compassionate and faithful. So we have this foreshadowing then of this a new covenant with a loyal son. So here's the summary. Revelation through the Sinai covenant. God's character, his person is holy. Yahweh is holy. God's desire is to have relationship with a treasured people who will partner with him in his plans and partners who participate in his holiness. I cannot be a partner in his plan without participating in his holiness. Right? I cannot show others that God, relationship with God is good if I am not living as if relationship with God is good. And God's plan is to create through that relationship a holy nation, a community that reflects his holiness by the way they relate with him and with each other. Commitment displayed through the Mosaic covenant is one of marriage. And it's entered into with an oath that's indicative of its seriousness. Each partner asking for the death if they break covenant relationship by being unfaithful, by not participating in their life. And it is endowed with the gift of continual communication. So here's the one thing that we don't recognize about Torah. When God gives Torah in the midst of a marriage ceremony, he is saying, I'm going to continually communicate with you. And that's understood in a marriage, right? Now that we're together, we're gonna be communicating all the time. A&E gods never did that, right? They just reacted. So this is for the Israelites, when they get Torah, they don't get it like we receive it. They get it like, what a gift. Our God's going to always be talking to us and giving us ideas of how we can reflect him, how we can actually be participating in his holiness, in his life. Wow, that's huge. So when they look at that, they don't look at those as restrictions. They look at those as, oh, good, I'm not going to get in trouble and live like a prostitute again. I'm going to have ideas of how to live as a married partner.
And it's putting each one first.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So there's this beautiful idea of it's living in pericritic union is always I'm giving out. That gives me life because it brings in the whole of the other person. It's always this flow here. So it's really hard for them to understand this, right? It's going to take them a long time to understand this. And obviously, we know they don't get it right, right? We wouldn't get it right. Which is why then we have this new covenant to be able to fulfill that. So, endowed with the gift of continual communication, that means that they've been provided with the means to assure faithfulness to the oath, to protect them against deadly disorder, right? Protect them against not having to God to fulfill the oath that they've taken. God, kill me if I, now I at least know how I can stay in order. And so that they can align their identity with their status, right? So that they can fulfill their image-bearing status. So the Torah for them is ways they can fulfill their status, the ways they can align their identity with their treasure possession status, align their identity with their regency and priestly statuses to come, that he has already said, this is what I'm going to be making you into. Yes.
So even though like there's that time between Old and New Testament where there's basically hundreds of years that they didn't hear from God, we always had Torah. He always had the instructions.
Yep.
Or the, I can't remember if they were, yeah, they were written down
yep.
by then. So even though we always have,
yep.
we always had our instructions
right.
from God.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. Anybody else have any questions? Yes, Margene.
Is that why Catholics and other denominations protect Holy Communion?
Yes, it is. So, again, so many times when we decide that we need to make things more relevant, we pull away from some of the stuff that's really important and understand. It's also, again, why so many churches have communion only once in a while instead of every week. Well, one of the purposes of installing Sabbath was so that weekly you could remember that you've made an oath, right? So that if there is the Lord's Supper once a week, weekly I'm back to, this is serious, I made an oath to be in communion, sharing life, right, together. That's a help to us. No matter how long it takes, it's a help to us. But it is why many churches protect it, and they're careful. Like, it's protection for you, right? I don't want you to take this flippantly. I don't want you to just go, yeah.
It wasn't meant to be exclusive. It was
correct. It's meant to protect you. I don't want you to go up and go, oh, that was good bread today. It's you walked through the pieces here, and Christ died. This relationship you have is one of shared life. It's not an independence where God just gives you some benefits. Anybody else have questions?
I went to a church once that did communion every week, but they did it at the end, and they did it so fast and furiously, they just, this is not the way it's.
I've seen some really, really strange things for communion. I won't go into them, but they were like, oh, you've lost it. You've lost what this is about.
I think that's maybe why some of them don't do it as often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there's lots of reasons.
More special.
There's lots of reasons, but yeah, I don't want to argue this. I mean, we do it every week. And that actually, to me, is huge. As I every week need to be pulled back and reminded, this is about me sharing my life with God, not beneficial. Father, thank you for giving us covenant, for giving us your life, that you walked through the pieces for us so that we might be able to live your life. Father, I pray that this week we might be very aware that the life we live is not our life, that you just shower blessings on, but Lord, that we're called to live your life so that others might see the goodness of living your life, that it isn't the sacrifices we make to give up our own identities is a great honor, And we get a much less, we upgraded to your life because of what you've done for us. Lord, may we walk in joy of that this week. In Jesus' name, amen.